In our view, if you're not lowering your perm rate at least 20 or 30 basis points or a bit more than what you could otherwise get with a comparable traditional perm rate, by taking on these additional risks, you shouldn't be doing that. If you have an alternative that doesn't involve these risks, take that one. And you should also, you don't want to be a fly-by-night borrower in the current environment. This will go away when the yield curve inversion corrects, and it's already begun to correct a little bit.
Welcome to Buzz House, a Baker Tilly podcast where you can hear all the buzz around multifamily housing with all the info you need to help you win now and anticipate tomorrow. Hi, I'm Don Bernards, the partner in charge of Baker Tilly's multifamily housing practice.
And I'm Gary Gibson, a partner at Baker Tilly, also specializing in consulting on multifamily housing transactions across the country.
Let's get started. We are very excited to welcome back into the Buzz House today, Wade Norris, a partner at the law firm Norris, George & Ostro. Many of our listeners may be familiar with Wade, who is truly, truly a leading expert in the taxes and bond field, not only for working on over 3,000 bond financings, but also Wade, of course, has played a major role in creating many of the innovative strategies across the taxes and bond market. Wade, thank you very much for joining us today. It's glad to have you on.
Thank you, Don. It's a pleasure to be with you.
In this podcast, Wade's going to discuss the current tax-exempt bond market and trending tax-exempt financing executions, of course, with tax-exempt bonds. We're going to jump right away into our discussion with Wade, so I'm going to turn it over to Garrick. Garrick?
Thanks, Don. And Wade, thanks for coming on our podcast once again. Before we jump into the questions that I'm eager to hear your responses for, why don't you let our listeners know a little bit more about the work you do and who your clients are?
Oh, great. Thank you, Garrick. Well, Norris, George & Ostro is a boutique law firm based in Washington, D.C. We specialize on the tax-exempt buy side of tax-exempt bond, debt, bond, and loan financings, primarily for affordable multifamily rental housing is our real specialty. We do some other muni bond executions as well, hospital revenue bonds, et cetera. But the real focus of the firm is affordable multifamily rental housing financings. Even though we're only 10 lawyers and 6 financial analysts, paralegals, we close about 150 deals a year across the United States, 35 or 40 states in a given year. We basically focus, as Don said, on working with our bank clients and our underwriter clients on developing new financial products that really provide an optimal execution on the tax-exempt debt side of these deals.
Perfect. Thanks for that introduction. Let's get into our questions. And before we start with this first question, I just want to let our listeners know there is some content posted where you can download this actual podcast that has some information and illustrations on inverted yield curves and rising yield curves that Wade will go over. So Wade, you know, you and I were discussing rising and inverted yield curves earlier. So could you elaborate on the current state of the market and walk us through what is actually happening with these yield curves?
Sure. No, thank you, Garrick. Well, it's no secret that beginning in early 2022, interest rates started moving upward. And we've had for the last 2 years a world of much higher interest rates and in inverted yield curves, very unusual. And the big impact of that, if you look at municipal bond issuance in general, that's a huge market. In muni bonds in general, it was approaching $500 billion a year in 2020 and 21, very active years. If you look at 22 and 23, that's down to right under around $400 billion, not close to $500 billion. So that's down. If you look at our affordable tax-exempt bond deals, for example, private activity bonds that we use with the 4% tax credits, that's down as well. You know, that's down. That grew by 20% per year from 2016 through about 2 years ago. And that's what caused many states to be oversubscribed on private activity bond volume, which we'll discuss a little later. But if you look at the last 2 years, we're down about 10% a year before last and about another 12% last year on 4% private activity bond executions, again, reflecting the higher interest rates that we've had and also higher construction costs, et cetera. But a large part of that has been the impact, Garrick, of those higher yield curves and the inversion that has occurred.
Very good. We just kind of feeding off of that question, in the past, when we've seen inverted yield curves, derivative products flooded the market, do you anticipate derivatives coming back given the current yield curves? And if so, what should borrowers be aware of?
Thank you, Don. Very good question. In point of fact, derivatives are back. Okay. It's sort of like the Goonies movie. It was very interesting. It's probably a year and a half ago or so. I get a call from a developer client who we work with for 30 years, and he's worked with one of our regional bank clients on a private placement for new construction, affordable housing financing. And he says, Wade, the bank is suggesting that we actually use a synthetic fixed rate on this, use a swap to set the perm rate. And my reaction was, really? Well, I haven't seen that since 2004, 5, and 6. And back then, we knew that borrowers with variable rate bonds were using swaps to set the perm rate, and they were achieving 40, 50 basis point yield reductions at the time. Now, we all know that ended pretty badly, because the borrowers, both governmental borrowers and private borrowers, didn't understand swaps and what some of the consequences were. And we'll chat about that in a minute. But I said, then, so what sort of reduction do you think we'll get in the perm rate? And he was really struggling to make the deal work with high rates and high costs, et cetera. He said, well, they're saying 65 basis points. And my reaction was, whoa, I've never seen that before. And I said, well, let me talk to the client. We're going to need to get you an independent registered muni advisor if we're talking to you about swaps and caps on a municipal bond deal. That's part of the municipal advisor's rule that came in after the 08 debacle. But let me talk to them. And so I called the client up and said, no way, we think right now that's about right. And so sure enough, we went in and did it, you know, and got an IRMA in there that to represent him so he fully understood what he was doing, et cetera, and is very successful, closed the gap and enabled him to do the deal. And the reason that works is the swap markets are huge multi-trillion dollar markets, okay? Our markets in muni bonds and multifamily muni bonds are minuscule by comparison. And our banks and other sponsors in private placements, which are still 75 or 80% of the executions we do, they generally set their perm rates based on their cost of borrowing, their indexes, their projected cost of borrowing over the next 17 or 18 years. The swap markets set their rates based on where they think rates will be next year and the year after. And so with this inverted yield curve that we've had a big difference now coming back in how the swap market set their perm rates and how traditional lenders set their permanent rates that has created this potential for a much lower rate if we set it with a synthetic rate by using a long duration swap, a 17 or 18 year swap on one of our multifamily deals. And we're also using caps on the pre-conversion rates in private placements. The biggest advantage of that, if you look at where with the inverted yield curve, most pre-conversion rates in placements are 1 month SOFR plus a spread. So 1 month SOFR is 530. Typical spreads, 200 basis points. It's a 730 floating rate during the pre-conversion or construction phase of the deal. Now, the bank or other private placement sponsor is going to say, well, we don't know that it will stay there. And so if you want to size a capitalized interest reserve before we got revenue coming in to pay interest that you'll owe during the construction and rent-up period, we're going to add a 200 basis points cushion to that. So we're going to look at it and assume it may go to 930, and we'll size your capitalized interest reserve based on that. Well, if you go out and buy a cap, not only may you save the interest you will actually pay during that period of time, if you buy a cap at 530 SOFR or 430 or 330 or even lower that we're seeing now, the cost of the cap will more or less offset the interest you're going to pay, the additional interest you'll pay, unless rates go in a way no one expects. But the big thing is it will enable you to dramatically lower that capitalized interest reserve that your lender is going to require. It may free up 2 or 3 or 4 or 5% more proceeds for other project costs by taking advantage of the caps in the current market. Now, using a swap to set the perm rate and try to achieve a lower perm rate to interest rate in the transactions, that's a much more complicated endeavor. And of course, what we discovered after the 08 financial crisis, when double, triple A swap counterparties like Lehman Brothers went bankrupt in October of 2008, what many of our borrower clients discovered and governmental borrowers discovered to their amazement was when their counterparty defaulted, even though they were performing their side of the deal completely, it terminated the swap. Okay, that's fine, but we all know if you default, you pay, right? There are damages, you pay. This is now not how derivatives work. This is now not swap markets. It is not a factor of who defaulted and whose fault it was. It's a matter of is that swap in the money or out of the money for the swap provider or the borrower. And generally in a low rate environment with rates going down, frankly, when you close the financing, if your counterparty fails immediately after closing, there will be a termination payment that the borrower will have to make that reflects the future value of the so-called swap spread within that rate to the other side of the party. So when we've actually seen there are really three components in setting a swap rate. There's the base borrowing rate with the swap yield curves set based on your projected amortization schedule over 16, 17, 18 years. There is a lender or loan spread built in there, and there is a swap spread built in there. And if you don't have a really good IRMA, you have no clue what those things are. But if the swap spread is too high and it terminates, then it can create a substantial additional debt obligation on your side. You may have an obligation to make a swap termination payment, even though you didn't default, your counterparty did, that can be 8 or 10 or 12% of your loan amount. And if rates go down more rapidly post-closing than the markets think they will, that can grow a little bit over time. So to get a lower rate, if that's why you're doing a swap, and that is the only reason you should do a swap on the perm side of the deal, you are taking on risk. And you need to understand these are sort of black swan risks. Nobody thinks their bank is going to default. Of course, nobody thought Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac would go into conservatorship in 2008 and that Lehman Brothers would default and all the other banks would default. These things can happen. So you have to be aware of that. You need a really good independent registered advisor and possibly swap counsel. We've done this together with Kensington Advisors and others for borrowers to help them assess the risk and understand what they're doing and negotiate competitive terms on that side of the deal. So it can be, in certain situations, an attractive device to lower your perm rate. In our view, if you're not lowering your perm rate at least 20 or 30 basis points or a bit more than what you could otherwise get with a comparable traditional perm rate, by taking on these additional risks, you shouldn't be doing that. If you have an alternative that doesn't involve these risks, take that one. And you should also, you don't want to be a fly-by-night borrower in the current environment. This will go away when the yield curve inversion corrects, and it's already begun to correct a little bit. If you look at the slides that were made available in that last one, you'll see a red line on the Treasury curve beginning to come down on the left side of that chart just a little bit. And rates are beginning to come down a little bit. All of the rates are, and the inversions are beginning to correct a little bit. So, you know, if you've got an execution that works on a perm rate in a traditional way with a lender you have a relationship with, that's how you should be doing your deal. If you need to do something else to make it work and save your deal, you should consider this, but you need to get help in evaluating the risk.
Yeah, thanks for that. I mean, that's a good summary on what those risks can likely be on those swaps that I don't think a lot of people really understand. But that kind of leads us into, you know, you talked about executions, right? So it seems to me like every time the market changes, there's always some new type of tax exempt bond execution that we see, right? Because they're trying to adapt to the markets, whether they're low short-term rates or high earnings rates. Could you touch on some of these trending bond executions and provide our listeners with some pros and cons? Because I know there's like MTEVs, there's cashback forward. There's a slew of them that are currently out there. And maybe you can give some insight on those.
Sure. No, glad to, Garrett. Thank you. One product that is, once again, a creature of the current yield curve environment, and I think you've already had a podcast on this, is the ability when the 2 and 3 year tax exempt yield curves went up so suddenly in 2022, over 200 basis points very quickly, the yield on these cashback bonds went from about a 1% yield to a 4% yield at the peak last summer. And if you can take that 2.5 years of that into basis, in addition to the interest you're paying on the other stream on your taxable drawdown loan, as I know you covered, it can put additional proceeds on the table at closing. And that's been an execution that we and others have been doing for the last 12 to 18 months very successfully. It does entail some cost. Well, an important point update on that is this works on any structure that has cashback bonds. More recently, we've begun to add cashback bonds to deals with a long-term perm loan private placement to achieve these results. And there's a possible positive arbitrage retention there that I'm sure you've discussed. But it also works if you're doing cashback bonds with a rural development loan, an FHA insured loan, a Fannie Mae forward MTEBs product. Those are all basically cashback bond issues. And this two streams of interest and additional basis opportunity exist on all of those executions, not just adding short-term cashback bonds to perm loan private placements. You do need to, as probably discussed, to make an election under 266 of the code to protect your claim to the capitalized basis. Generally speaking, most advisors will say, look, we need to have someone related to the borrower pay federal income tax on the earnings in the escrow. That's sort of the offset of getting the basis increase. Okay. That's probably going to be your tax credit equity investor. They are almost certainly a 21% taxpayer. That's why you have them do it. And they may ding you a penny or maybe two pennies. And if they're really greedy, three pennies on the tax credit equity pricing. Frankly, if they have other roles in the deal, they shouldn't be dinging you at all, or it should only be a penny or so. And maybe if they have no other role in the deal, a penny or two or whatever. But even net, it's still beneficial. Now, as rates have begun to go down, okay, the coupon, we just closed the $65 million cashback deal where we're closing tomorrow. We priced it last week. The coupon was 3.2%. It wasn't 4%. Okay, so the increased basis play is already beginning to come down a bit. We've done projections. We think if interest rates on the tax-exempt yield curves go down over 2024 half as fast as they went up in 2022, we think this opportunity may have been largely offset by the cost by the end of the year. We'll have to see how that plays out. Sometimes these things take longer. Sometimes they materialize even more quickly than we think. But it is still a very viable opportunity that we and others are doing on these deals. Any structure that has cashback bonds, you should be doing this. And once again, when you're adding it to tax-exempt perm loan, there is an opportunity. There are a lot of complexities in how you do this, and you have to discuss it with bond counsel in advance. You may be able to retain a bit of positive arbitrage that is now available on these executions. Net result in the current market might be 2.5% of total development costs in the right situation, but an opportunity that's still there, people should seize upon where you have these executions, but it's one that we think will erode as the yields come back down. Other developments we're seeing in general, I think, are some interesting executions that reflect where the market is going. If you look at the municipal bond markets generally, we talked about how big they were at the beginning of the podcast. Well, about 25 or 30% of the buy side of that $400 billion a year market are the tax-exempt bond funds. Okay. And as we covered in a prior podcast a couple of years ago, in 2019, 20, and 21, they had huge inflows coming in. Rates were very low. They had money flooding in. The world was awash with cash. There had been so much fiscal stimulus following the pandemic. If you look at M1, the money supply, it was up by a factor of five following the pandemic, money in everyone's hands they were trying to put to work. They had to put it to work. We got very low yields. We got generous underwriting criteria. And we used that to create a whole new market for middle-income workforce housing, $9 billion of bonds issued over 3 years in California, Texas, and some other locations to provide affordable workforce housing by doing high-yield, unrated 40-year bonds and selling them to the bond funds who had to put that money to work. Well, with the rates going up in 22 and 23, guess what? those inflows have turned into outflows. So now the bond funds have had money streaming out more quickly, not as quickly as it was streaming in those 19, 20, 21 years, but money streaming out, not coming in. So those markets have pretty much dried up. We've seen very little execution on that very robust platform. Now, we were beginning to see, if you look at the Investment Company Institute data that the bond buyer publishes, the last 3 weeks have been inflows again. And as rates are coming down, BlackRock says there's $17 trillion of cash assets in the hands of Americans right now. A lot of that is parked in money market funds that are earning 4 and 5%. Well, as the short-term yields begin to come down, those money market fund yields are coming down. And I think what we're going to see over the next year is people beginning to go out further and put money back into longer-term fixed-rate debt instruments in order to get a better yield. And as that happens, I think we may see more inflows and we may see some return of that type of execution. At the moment, the yields are too high, the spreads are too wide, but we've seen the beginnings of what may be some return to that. But what has actually worked in the last year, year and a half that we're seeing, a very new type execution, these deals were done in the Pacific Northwest even before this, but we've begun to see an execution where we have housing authorities. There are a number of housing authorities, for example, that are rated, investment grade rated. They own a number of properties. They have big balance sheets, et cetera. And they may be AA plus rated, AA rated, A minus rated, et cetera. And we are seeing executions now. We are structuring 10-year bonds. They can afford a refinance option because they have a flexible balance sheet. And we actually closed two deals this past December with rated housing authorities where basically we issued A-plus rated bonds with a 10-year maturity, use the proceeds to enable the housing authorities to acquire existing projects or build projects. They may be projects that meet the revenue procedures for lower income housing. They may be actually private activity bond deals that the housing authority is doing, or they may just be essential function bond deals where a housing authority is making the units affordable at 80, 100, 120% of area median. But we achieved yields of 430 and 435 on those 10-year bonds in December. A lot of things work at a 430 or a 435 yield. Almost nothing works at a 7 yield. And so we've seen more and more of these executions as housing authorities or a city that really needs the housing, wants the housing, is willing to put its credit behind bonds, maybe for a nonprofit owner in the jurisdiction, but we're hitting that rated, investment grade rated, 10-year, maybe 15-year maturity. We're beginning to see more and more of that being done to create affordable rental housing. We're also seeing, I think, as a general matter, I think we're going to see, as we get more appetite with money flowing back into the bond funds, et cetera, and retail investors wanting to put their money to work in longer duration investments like muni bonds, I think we're going to see retail executions in our space begin to come back to a bigger degree. A good example of that, I think, in the current market is if you look at the Fannie Mae MTEBS product. We worked with Fannie Mae to create the MTEBS product back in 2014, and very attractive execution. It's a 17-year AAA rated bond, tax exempt, et cetera, backed initially by a verified escrow of cash and government securities during the pre-conversion phase when you have a bank lender making the real loan on the project and Fannie Mae is standing by. And then at conversion, they issue a mortgage-backed security, an MBS that replaces the cash treasury collateral for those fixed rate bonds and comes into play. If you look at the spreads on MTEBs, it can be compared to the 10-year MMD, but the yield that everyone knows is the 10-year treasury yield. Everyone knows right now, unfortunately, I got up this morning and it jumped from around 4 to 420, ruined my day. But, you know, it's bobbing around a 4 now, not the 498 that it hit last October 25th. Having that come down to around a 4 has been a real plus in many, many regards. But if you look at that, typically on a Fannie Mae MTEB, you would have a yield spread to the 10-year treasury of, let's say, maybe 100 basis points or a little more. So if you got a 4% 10-year treasury, maybe a 5% yield on those bonds. And when they put in their guarantee and servicing fees, it may be 80, 90, 100 basis points. It's a 6% borrowing rate. Okay. Very attractive borrowing rate, not a sweetheart rate in the current market, but a very attractive rate in the current market, and much better than the rates we had 6 months ago. But now those spreads are actually coming down on that type of bond. It may be an 80 or 90 basis point spread to the 10-year, not a 100 basis point spread, or even a little narrower. And we're seeing even lower guarantee servicing fees. So that type of execution, we're beginning to see, but it's becoming more and more competitive, I think, given that we have buyers returning to the muni bond market to put their money at work at higher yields.
Very good. A lot of really, really good information, Wade. I know our listeners will enjoy that. Wade, one last question, and this is kind of the tip of everyone's tongue, right? We've all seen, as of this recording, the Tax Relief for American Families and Workers Act of 2024, which again has passed the House, a very bipartisan, headed to the Senate. I think a lot of people are like, great, that's going to free up, that's going to create more units, more deals. But I think our question for you is, right, reducing the 50% test to 30% for 24, 25, what is this going to do? How is this going to affect the tax and bond market, right? That's the big question, really, that's on our mind and probably your mind as well.
Let me drop back and give a little history that I think may be interesting to the audience. If you look at, we have our map of the United States of which states are oversubscribed. I think multiple players have their own maps. We have our version. If a state becomes oversubscribed, we like to pull it up into Canada or out in the Atlantic or Pacific Ocean or the Gulf of Mexico on our map. We think that's fun. But if you look at our map 2 years ago, we had California certainly out in the Pacific Ocean. Texas is down the Gulf of Mexico. And at that point, we estimated, and we don't just look at applications versus volume awarded. We actually call our colleagues, because when you're assessing oversubscription, we think it's important to take into account the developers who would have applied but didn't apply because they knew they had no chance of getting it. In California, for example, for a good part of 20 and 21, if you had an acquisition rehab deal, a preservation deal in California, you wouldn't bother to apply because they were prioritizing new construction. There was a big state tax credit for only for new construction to make deals work. And while they had 7 billion of applications for the 3.5 billion of private activity bond volume that the state devotes to multifamily, there was probably another 3.5 billion that never applied on preservation deals because, hey, no chance we're going to get it. Well, that has changed. What has happened over the last 2 years, as interest rates have gone up, which we've discussed, construction costs have gone up, and the volume has come down, as we discussed in the early part of the podcast, it's taken the pressure off of that a bit. We think Texas is now more like 2-to-1 oversubscribed based on the last year. California, maybe 2-to-1 oversubscribed because of those factors. So we've already gotten some relief from the severe oversubscription we had 2.5, 3 years ago, just due to those factors. Now, as rates come back down, again, more things will work and that will push the other way. But for that's where we are at the moment, even before the proposed legislation. The some states, ironically, just to throw it out because it's kind of interesting, are actually more oversubscribed, notwithstanding higher rates and higher costs. If you look at Colorado, last year, their oversubscription went up. But the reason was they doubled the amount of state tax credit dollars coming into these deals through a legislative change so that more deals work, right? Oregon, something of the same way for a somewhat different reason. But by and large, the oversubscription has come down over the last 2 years. The act, if it is enacted, now, as we all know, it has passed the House. And again, just to summarize from the technical summary in the bill, this will apply to bonds that are issued before 2026. So the bonds have to be issued before that date. There's actually, and it's for projects that are placed in service after December 31 of 23. Okay, those are two fundamental things. And there's actually an interesting transition rule in there. Basically, the building has to have 5% or more of its aggregate basis financed by bonds with an issue date in 24 or 25. So you might have a deal where you actually issued a good bit of bonds for it in 2023, okay, but you still need more bond authority. Maybe you need it to meet the 50% test, you had cost overruns or whatever. I think they've left the door open here, if I'm reading this correctly, to enable some of those projects to come in. And if you get 4 or 5% more of your aggregate basis financed with bonds issued in 24 or 25, that project may qualify for the 30% test as well, if this is correct. Now, where will this go? Will it be enacted? Well, it has passed the House. I think it's widely known that it has very broad bipartisan support. It is going to the Senate. But on the other hand, the AHCIA had this in there in 2016. And we've tried on multiple occasions to get some version of this passed through. I think our chances now, particularly having passed the House, are better than they ever were. I think there is a very good chance it will be adopted. But again, as we know from legislative actions in Congress back in 2017, when they almost abolished all private activity bonds for hospital, nonprofit hospitals and higher ed and single family and multifamily housing, anything can happen on the Hill. And so, and it's tax legislation, and there's wheeling, dealing, and babies get thrown out with the bathwater every day. And so I wouldn't count on this until it's done. Now, if the Senate passes it, the president will sign it in a heartbeat. But, you know, it, and it may take a little time. I'm told this is not next week or the week after. You know, it's going to have to work its way through in a number of discussions. But I do think there's an excellent chance we'll get this. And I think if we do, it will be a big help. You know, I think it will free up a number of additional deals that can work. Again, you have to remember that it isn't a total panacea. It will mean that projects on the debt side are going to have a higher percentage of their debt side financing coming from taxable debt, not tax exempt debt. That's going to raise the blended yield on that side a little bit. And on a debt service constrained loan, it will shrink the loan a little bit. Not major, but a factor. Also, it means we're going to be dumping a lot more 4% tax credit equity into a limited market, right? And so what does that do to tax credit equity pricing? Is it a penny, two, three? I don't know. But, you know, it will have some effects of that sort that will water it down just a little bit. I don't think it'll be a linear percentage increase in the deals that will work, but it will be certainly a big help if we're fortunate enough to have this go all the way through and get signed into law.
Very good. That's so much good information, Wade. We really appreciate it. That's it for this episode of The Buzzhouse. Again, a big thanks to Wade Norris of Norris, George & Ostro. Talk about the current tax exempt market, what's next. Talk about the Tax Relief for American Families and Workers Act 2024. Wade, thank you much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for the opportunity. Bye-bye.
Once again, I'm Don Bernards.
And I'm Garrett Gibson. Don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss an episode. For additional resources around multifamily housing, check out BakerTilly.com. If you have a suggestion for the show, email us at buildabakertilly.com. That's B-U-I-L-D at BakerTilly.com. See you next time on Buzzhouse.